Accession number 9202, roll number 6.
Mr. Ray, Reel 6, you said you met St. Clair Tisdale on the beach and that you later on found that he'd been involved in an act of gallantry. Could you tell me what it was, what you heard about that he'd done?
Well, as the ship was head on to the beach, it seemed to be an appropriate idea for him, in a sense, taking things into his own hands, seeing that the men were unable to get ashore, he dived from the peak of the ship, into the water, and swam what little way there was to the shore, and began his work of rescue, or trying to rescue what he could. And that's about all that I knew at the time of St. Clair Tisdale.
Now, your job on the beach was unloading ammunition from the lighters and putting them into...
No. Not unloading anything. The ammunition was already there, you see. You know the panniers that used to carry ammunition in? The panniers were what they use in the machine gun. You know, they sort of put them in. It's in my mind, but I can't explain it now. You see, the ammunition, the bullet, it was small arm ammunition, and it wasn't just lying around, but it was all in, it was in order, and yet it wasn't in order. It was just putting it in piles, so that anyone who came along could lift up two or three of these panniers of ammunition and take them off. You see.
Were you doing it? Now this was the Wednesday. Were you doing it all day?
No, it was just a matter of about an hour's job, an hour's worth. That's all.
What else did you do in that day?
Well, I can't remember anything else. Just that. I was with the rest of the company. C Company was my company of the Anson Battalion. Now we were formed into our own unit. I was attached, by the way, as a battalion signaller. That was my duty, that was my job, apart from this getting the stuff ashore, foodstuffs and what have you, or if they like it. I was also a battalion signaller.
What did that involve?
I was trained as a battalion signaller, and along with others from the battalion, we were formed into a section. The company had their own signalers, but the battalion, as a one unit, had the battalion signalers. We were a little extra. We'd had a little extra training. There was a yeoman of signals from the Navy, see? When we were doing our initial training in England, see? That was what we were doing. Now, I think the people in charge thought that there'd be a lot of... the type of work that would fall to the lot of men that were in the country, signalling from distances with the flags and and the lamp. We had a lamp, you know, one. I can't say whether it was a name like Addis lamp. It wasn't a heliograph lamp, and yet it was. It could be used in conjunction with the sun. Some while after, we were a friend of mine, a pal of mine, I remember his name, it was Wilf Appleton, he came from Darlington, and we used to work together, and there was one day, just in this period that I'm speaking about, when he and I were in the country, on our own, and we had to get to a certain point where the units were, because with this lamp and the flags that we were carrying, we had to carry this lot.
This is during training in England?
No, this is actually on the spot.
At Gallipoli.
This is actually following on after this event on the beach where I'm talking about, you know. And it's the following up, you see. So anyway, we had to cross some no man's land. You know, it wasn't very safe, but of course, I suppose we didn't take a great deal of notice, either of us. And anyway, we had to go a distance, about half the length of this street, and we got across this territory, you know, this land, no man's land.
About 50 yards.
Oh, yeah, 50 yards. By zigzag methods, you know. But we lost the lamp. It was smashed to smithereens. And that could only have been through sniper's bullets. See? Don't know what the sniper thought we were carrying, but we had this lamp, and we were carrying it with the signalling flags, the pole. We pushed that onto the handles and yoked ourselves into, you know, carried it across between us. And we got to where the unit or section of the unit were sheltering from the bombardment that they were getting. And without thinking anything about it, the officer in charge, he said, where have you come from? And we said, well, we'd just come across this stretch of land. Well, he said, and you're all right? And we were absolutely, neither of us had a scratch. But yet that lamp was, I said, the lamp's broken, smithereens. And it was. He said, well, in passing, he said, this is just one of these, I don't suppose it was intended, wasn't intended as a joke. He said, you deserve the VC. Well, that was the end of our business as signalers. It seemed that there wasn't any need for it, because we couldn't make the progress as they expected. If I may allow myself to say this, following on Sir Ian Hampton's idea, when he made his initial plans to do what they intended doing on Gallipoli, he, along with others, thought all they had to do was to land and just mop up the remnants of the Turks. And that was that. See? And then just go straight forward. But they found that when we got on to the shore, that it wasn't so. The Turk was a different fighter to what they'd been led to believe, see?
Had your unit joined up by this time to become a complete unit? Because on the Wednesday you said it was still split up. Had it unified by...
On the Wednesday, oh yes, I'm going forward now, you see. I'm going on now to a few days ahead, you see.
What happened in the interval? Nothing...
Well, we were in a sort of a camp, you know. We weren't in tents. We were more or less in the open, but we dug ourselves in, into the soil, into the land, and made ourselves bivouacs. You see, with ground sheets to cover over the top, you see, to ward off the rain or anything like that.
So you were in these bivouacs for some days. Did you get adequate food while you were there?
We didn't get much. It was more or less. It wasn't much more than iron rations.
How about water?
Water. Well, we didn't do too badly for water, but as far as I can recall. It didn't affect me, the water business. Mind you, what did catch me was the diarrhea, dysentery, night time.
So early on it caught you?
Yes. Quite a lot. You see, through the day, the sun used to beat down mercilessly, you know. It was really, really red hot. And at night time, it seemed to be just the opposite. It was really cold. And it used to find us at the improvised toilet still. Lined up, some of us, with a blanket over your body, shoulders, and spend most of your time there, night time. But fortunately for me, I seemed to get over that. You know.
What sort of improvised latrine was it? Was it the pole method?
Uh-huh. Long pole. Yeah.
Were a lot of the men very ill with this, then?
Quite a few.
Did most of them make recoveries like you, or did some of them have to be taken off or die?
Oh, there was a lot. Well, there again, I know there were quite a lot of men that had dysentery, and they were going sick, you know, to the doctors, the next thing they'd be taken off, you know, go. If they weren't too bad, they could. Or if they were bad at all, they used to. If they were too bad, then they used to go off. You wouldn't see them again, you know, go to the hospital ship and away. Out of there. But it was a well known fact that there were lots of men who died from dysentery.
When did the dysentery hit you about?
It hit me pretty early on. But mind you...
In the first week?
No. No, not as quickly as that, no. No, let's see, I was on from April, May. It would be in May, about the middle of May. But I wasn't all that greatly concerned about the dysentery, you see. But I knew it was there.
Where was this camp then that you'd set up?
Well, it was on the peninsula.
You can't remember what was near it?
Well, we near the Saddle Bar. Near to Saddle Bar. And that was the fort. That was one of the forts.
While you were in the camp, what duties did you have?
Well, it wasn't a camp. It was being in active service. You were in the trenches, you see, as well. You were partially trenches and out of the trenches by being relayed with somebody else, and you'd come back, say, to these bivouacs where you were, and be there for the night, you see.
Where was the Anson battalion placed in the line when it was in the line then?
It was placed, on the peninsula itself.
Which bit of the peninsula? Can you remember vaguely?
Cape Helles.
Oh, I wondered within that whether you knew. You just know it was in the front line at Helles.
Yes, that's all. That's all we were.
What were the trenches like that you were served in May?
Nothing near like the trenches that we afterwards accustomed to being in France. Of course, they'd had more experience of trench warfare there. But we used to go down. Well, we'd go down about, say, the depth of that table, you know, to the floor.
So about 1'6", 2'.
Well, yes. And then somebody would come along and they'd say, well, you'll have to go down lower than that, you know. And we used to think that was far enough. But then we soon realised that we really had to get down quicker, to get farther down than that, until we did get a proper system of trenches. Although we didn't intend, it wasn't the intention to stay roundabout like that in trenches. You see, the idea was to push forward, but the situation. It wasn't that fluid that you could move backwards and forwards. The opposition was too strong.
So how deep did they eventually become, the trenches, while you were in them?
About half the half this the distance of that
three foot
up to the board there, you know, a little bit. There. No, a bit farther than that. There. Yeah.
About four foot then. And did they build up parapets in front of them?
Yes.
What about fire steps? Did you have those?
Not much, no.
Not much need.
No.
Did they have sophistications like traverses in them, or were they just more straight?
Communication.
Traverses, you know.
Well,
zigzag.
I know what you mean. There was the parador and the paradox, and the parador and the parapet, wasn't there? You had your parador was the part of the tent that you went through, wasn't it, into the next bay. Anyway, we didn't. No, not it wasn't as far advanced as that.
Did you have communication trenches?
Yes.
In May they'd already set.
May and June we were on that whenever we had the opportunity, or were given the opportunity, we had to make the trenches. Yes.
What about in front of the trenches? Would you have barbed wire and things, or at this stage, the early stage?
No. I cannot envisage having barbed wire, unless it might have been just one reel of wire. You know.
How far away were the Turks?
I don't think. There didn't seem to be any set plan then. You see, it was just a sudden attack.
No, how far away were they?
Yes, I don't remember. I couldn't really define how far away from them, how far we were separated. It used to just be a sort of a guess, hit or miss, you know.
Could you see them at all?
No. Well, no, you didn't see them.
You see where the trenches were, I mean?
No, you couldn't see anything about any trenches either. There seemed to be a certain amount of freedom of movement. That was, of course, through the day, that was to be expected, wasn't it? You know, not exactly to be expected, because there wasn't a lot of artillery used by the Turks, although there was a certain amount. The situation didn't call for it, or couldn't call for it, because we were the force that was the attacking force, and the Turks, well, they couldn't afford to keep their artillery in front of this big Bibaba, a natural fortress, you see, like a big huge mountain, something like you know, some of the hills in Wales, you know. You haven't heard anything about or read anything about this business in on Gallipoli, an insurmountable stretch of land and rock, stretching almost from one side to the other of the peninsula, you know.
Was there much vegetation or scrub?
Yes, a bit. Yes, there'd been quite a bit of vegetation, yes.
What sort was?
It was just scrub, a lot of it, yes. But then, of course, I suppose before we got there, there'd been a lot of it turned up and chewed up and so forth.
When you were in the front line, I'd like to... Was there much sniping going on either side? Did you snipe or did they snipe?
They sniped, yeah. They sniped more than we. I don't think that... I didn't know any of our people who were sniping. But... And there was quite a lot of several of our men were picked up and they were killed just by not going out, not taking enough care, because it wasn't not taking care, they were just going about their work, sort of thing. But somebody, you know, if they showed themselves too much throughout the day, it was just too bad. They were picked up, just like that.
Was there much machine gun fire from the Turks?
Yes. There was machine guns there, yes. There was quite a lot of firing going after them at night time, which was, I suppose, to be expected, because when it was dark, there would be a little bit of panic stations, you know, in case you were roundabout and you didn't know whereabouts you were, sort of thing.
What about bombing? Was there any bombing going on? Hand bombing?
No, hand grenades, no. Nothing much of that, no.
You didn't have makeshift bombs or anything issued, did you?
No.
That hadn't happened then.
No. It may have happened with the Anzacs, with the Australians and New Zealanders, round in Subla Bay, you know, round another part of the island, the Dardanelles, but not with us.
Were there any patrols going out from the front line while you were there?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge. There wasn't the breadth or the depth up front, you know, that we had in France. Follow?
I follow. We discussed a bit about the food and water earlier. When you were in the front line, was the situation pretty well the same, or did you get any better food or water? I mean, did you get more?
Well, I wasn't. We got bullied beef and jam and cheese and bread. I can't say much about bread because, no, honestly, I couldn't say very much about bread. But I know those biscuits, you know, the without the weevil.
Where did you actually sleep? Just in the bottom of the trench, or did you have some dugouts dug out? Or
who'd sleep in anywhere?
Just on the floor of the trench or on the fire?
Oh, yeah, anywhere. Yeah. That was the. There were no. There was nothing special about. You know, just have a dust. You have to just make the best of it.
Could you tell me what you'd do on a typical day in the front line from when you got up to when you went to sleep? What sort of things you'd do in a day? It doesn't have to be in strict order.
Well, you first of all had a roll call. That was the first thing you had in the morning. It was I remember a petty officer. Our ranks, ratings were naval, you see. Petty officers and leading seamen and so forth, and I remember a petty officer named Tommy Bennett, and a real town side chap, you know. How are you going on? He'd call the roll, and he would call the roll while you were in your various bivouacs, you see, and there'd be.
That's so when you're out of the line. What about when you're in the line? Carry on.
Anyway. Oh, well, when you're in the line, it didn't matter. They knew that you were... That if anything happened, it was just knowledge then, you see. Mm. If anything happened in the line, well, there wasn't any need to call the roll.
Stand to first thing in the morning, then, in the line?
No, no.
There was no stand to, morning stand
to? Not there, not in that sense, no.
What did you
no,
do?
No, it wasn't. It strictly wasn't war. It was a Mosier Golgi police competition, really, to be quite perfectly honest. Now, I'm speaking about. I'm saying this because I know what the experiences were in relation with France